Before we start the show today, I just want to remind you that we are now producing new bonus content and a weekly wrap-up show for everyone who supports the podcast on Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/ampedup, and for as little as $5 a month, you'll get two new bonus videos and bonus shows with me and my producer, Rob, a week. Thanks again for supporting the podcast. Welcome to Amped Up. This is your host, Ryan Knight, and our guest today is Danny Haifeng. Danny is the contributing editor of the Black Agenda Report. He's the co-host of the Left Lens podcast. He's an organizer with No Cold War and the author of the book, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence. Danny, welcome to Amped Up.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Look, you know, we're in the worst recession since the Great Depression, and the Democrats control the entire government, and they are scaling back the $600 expanded unemployment benefits that they initially promised to $400, and the $2,000 relief checks that Biden had promised are now only $1,400. Chuck Schumer yesterday, after leaving the White House, said, and I quote, "There's agreement, a universal agreement, that we must go big and bold." But big and bold means $2,000 monthly relief checks and the original $600 expanded unemployment benefits, not a $1,400 one-time check and the measly $400 expanded unemployment. Democrats don't even need the Republicans to pass this. They could pass it right now through reconciliation in the Senate. Danny, what does it say about the Democratic Party that during one of the worst economic crises in U.S. history, their definition of big and bold is a one-time $1,400 check, which is less, by the way, than the $1,800 in relief that Trump gave us last year?
Well, what it says, Ryan, is that the Democrats are completely indebted not to their political constituencies, which I believe are captive to a corporate party, and that the Democrats are serving corporate interests and serving the interests of capital. And this was to be expected given what we saw during the primary when Bernie Sanders was once again rigged of his chance to run against Donald Trump, and the entire Democratic Party establishment coalesced around Joe Biden, who has a 50-year record of serving credit card corporations, Wall Street banks, military contractors, and the like in order to ensure that the rich keep getting richer and that the workers and the poor keep getting poorer. And so while it shouldn't have surprised people who, especially a lot of those folks right after Biden won the election, the general election, ended up celebrating and having brunch and all of this, it shouldn't have surprised them that Joe Biden would go back on his promise, a very basic promise, to at least provide a $2,000 payment to workers all over the country, tens of millions of whom have lost their job. But this really is indicative of this politics of austerity that the Democratic Party has been playing for more than 40 years. And these politics are completely in line with what is a bipartisan consensus on endless war and endless cutbacks for poor people and working people. And this needs to be recognized more than ever, because at this time, what we are seeing with the Biden administration is a consolidation of power, a consolidation of state power and corporate power. And the two are intertwined. And without more recognition of this, more and more people are going to accept the very little that they're being offered. And every time they're offered something by the Democrats, what ends up happening is they end up seeing their conditions worsen as a result. And this very abusive relationship between poor people, working people, black people, the immigrant movement, et cetera, it really needs to be exposed, because at the end of the day, nothing will change unless more people, especially progressives and leftists, chart a different course politically.
Yeah, and I like that you touched on the fact that we're seeing a consolidation of power between the corporate state and the military state. And we saw this actually this past weekend when the corporate media machine went into overdrive to protect Joe Biden. Newsweek and the Daily Mail, you know, two corporate publications, Notice that Biden, hashtag Biden lied, was trending number one in the country because myself and a few other prominent progressive activists, you know, basically just said, dude, you promised $2,000 checks and you promised the $2,000 after Trump had cut the $600 checks in December. There was no down payment, right, when they were campaigning this whole. And what I just find so just sinister is they're saying, well, oh, no, the $600 down payment counts toward the $2,000. They're taking Trump's $600 payment. And you can't find one rally. You can't find any campaign rally where the Democrats were promising $1,400 because they weren't. They were promising $2,000. And so to see Newsweek did a story and they said, Biden's critics falsely claim that Joe Biden lied about $2,000 checks. Now, here's what's fascinating is, well, in the story, they actually said, you know, one of the most prominent critics, Joe Biden critics, is podcast host and progressive activist Ryan Knight, falsely claiming that, you know, Biden promised that Biden has, walked back his promise of $2,000. And they went in and actually used the DNC talking point of, well, no, it's the $600 passed under Trump plus $1,400. And two days later, then they retracted and they said that we weren't lying. Newsweek put a correction to the story and they said, well, actually, they weren't falsely claiming that actually Biden did claim the $2,000 check. So talk about the danger that we have now that, look, we know that now the corporate media won't hold Joe Biden and the Democrats accountable. Progressives in the squad aren't holding Joe Biden accountable. And so we have a party that now controls our entire government and no one to hold them accountable. The few people who do, leftists like yourself and myself, we're actually starting to be deplatformed from platforms like Facebook, just kicked off a bunch of socialist accounts, and YouTube just deplatformed a bunch of leftists. So they're actually, you add in big tech, and it's like we're going to have this neoliberal consolidation of power and no way to fight back against it. It's beyond anything it's so dangerous. And then you don't really hear people talking about how dangerous it is. Because again, you just hear Democrats saying, oh, but Trump bad, when he's gone.
Yes, you're exactly right. And I've been writing about this for more than a few years now, about how the Democratic Party has become the political engine of American exceptionalism directed against the left. So the left is viewed as the spoiler and as the insidious force, which is inevitably going to bring the United States down from its so-called peak of civilization. And that's why the left was connected to Russia during the Trump administration. That's why the left was blamed for 4+ years for the rise of Donald Trump politically. And that's why we see this continued assault on the digital platforms, online platforms, social media companies, all of them, the Silicon Valley, all of them have coalesced with the military state, because this is inevitably in a military operation. It's about political control, and political control always means that the military state is involved, whether it's through the intelligence apparatus or directly. And so what is happening is that the Biden administration predictably is now looking toward its foes on the left in order to ensure that if they are weakened, then the Biden administration can go on with the bipartisan consensus as usual, the consensus on endless war, the consensus to enrich Wall Street, to enrich major corporations and financial institutions at the expense of the working class. That is really what this political moment is all about right now. It isn't about some kind of sigh of relief, which a lot of liberals, a lot of people on the neoliberal end of the spectrum are right now breathing. Really what's happening is there is a consolidation of corporate power taking place in order to pave the way for something. I know you've said this and many astute followers have said this, that on the left, that Joe Biden's administration is inevitably going to develop something even worse than Donald Trump politically, because all of the energy and the repression of the state, of these corporations, of the ruling class, is directed at socialists, at communists, at anyone who considers themselves outside of the establishment political line. And that should tell people once it is publicized and once more and more people understand what's going on. This should tell people exactly where the Democratic Party falls, that it falls as an institution of social control meant to weaken the left, actually send the left to what we at Black Agenda Report calls the graveyard of social movements, right? It's right. All about absorbing the left and then strangling them from within. That's what's happening. And it's important that we continue to talk about this, because what's happening already is that conditions are getting worse for people, that all of these rollbacks of promises like the $2,000 stimulus check only prolongs the suffering that working class people right. are going through right now. And this goes across the board. Some folks say that we're not focusing enough on race or racism. Well, no one's talking about how Joe Biden is the architect of the mass incarceration state and the killings of Black people at the hands of the police and the disproportionate incarceration of Black people at the hands of this mass incarceration state is not going to be addressed by Joe Biden. Actually, Joe Biden just opened up a facility for undocumented children to serve as overflow capacity. So he's not even keeping his promise around reuniting families of undocumented immigrants. What he's doing is he's actually escalating the situation by ensuring that this massive detention and incarceration center for undocumented immigrants is expanded and can function better. And I think that's a lesson in how the Democratic Party is really the more effective evil of capital and the more effective evil of all of the various ills that this system produces.
Yeah, you know, people get into this argument, and I myself, you know, I didn't fully radicalize and become like an anti-capitalist leftist until probably the beginning of actually of 2020. So it's only been like a year. And, you know, I used to be one of those Democrats who fell under the spell of the whole lesser of two evils. Yeah, both parties are crap, but like, let's just vote for the lesser of two evils. One of the things that became really clear to me, you know, when I started waking up and seeing that, you know, the Democratic Party is just as corrupt as the Republican Party. They just dress up their corruption a lot better. You know, while the Republicans are very brazen and very bold about their corruption, you know, like, oh, we're going to war, or, you know, we're passing massive tax breaks for the billionaire class. The Republicans just basically brag about that they work for the ruling class and don't give a crap about the working class. The Democrats, you know, on the other hand, they do the exact same thing. They govern for the ruling class. They're funneling more money to their corporate donors, to Wall Street, to the military-industrial complex. But then what they do, very sinisterly, is they go on corporate media, they go on CNN, and they sedate the public with these platitudes of hope and change and make all these promises that they're never going to deliver on, and then turn around and govern for the 1% while they're screwing over the 99%. And so for me, one of my big epiphanies is like, there is no lesser of two evils. The entire system is evil. The entire system is corrupt. And you can't have a nation of endless war and imperialism and predatory capitalism that just continues to funnel more and more wealth up to the oligarchs, while the poor and the working class just keep getting poorer and poorer. And it's created this instability. And so I think when you talk about brunch and liberals, you know, breathing a sigh of relief, I think that their sigh of relief is going to be short-lived, because I think they, from the beginning, most liberals misdiagnosed the problem. The problem was never Donald Trump. He was always a symptom of our corrupt system. And so when people, you know, the fact that Joe Biden is now going back to and peddling the same failed neoliberal politics that got us here and that created Trump in the first place, and he's already trying to go back to this business as usual status quo politics that is failing, that is only going to continue to push people to, and what happens is people either are going to go more to the right toward neo-fascism, or they're going to go towards socialism. And the whole point is we want people to go towards socialism. We want people to go left. But when the Democratic Party is not offering any real socialist policies and any real kind of opposition to this neo-fascism you're seeing on the right, that's actually what prevents people from waking up and moving left, right? So talk about just kind of the insanity that, like, in this moment, that Joe Biden is going back to the same conditions that led to Trump in the first place, and how liberals are so disconnected from the what the root of the problem is. The root of the problem is capitalism. Capitalism is in decay. It's not working anymore. Maybe it worked in the 60s and 70s. It never worked for everyone, right? In order to have a ruling class, you have to have a poor and a working class for the ruling class to exploit. But it worked for more people, you know, back in the 60s and 70s. It's in complete decay right now. And I think there's just this denial that we need to move to a better economic system.
Definitely. And this is really a moment of self-preservation for this over this entire economic and political order that is capitalism, it is imperialism in the United States. And the Democratic Party's role at this moment is to preserve and to actually revive this ideology of American exceptionalism. It's not to serve the interests of its constituents. That has never really been the function of the Democratic Party from the time when it was the Dixiecrat Party to the last 50, 60 years since it's been the so-called party of the quote-unquote left. In reality, the Democratic Party has never served the interests of working people unless working class people themselves rose up, organized, and resisted the predations of capital and the inherent relationship, as you said, between the worker and the boss, the corporation and the poor. That relationship is inherently exploitative. It is about extracting profit through surplus value, through literally stealing the wages and the livelihoods away from people. And this relationship has become more and more apparent as this system develops. And the Democratic Party, especially since the 1990s, has taken up the role of preserving this system and trying to stabilize it, while the GOP has long been, over the same period, known as the white man's corporate party. That it was well known that the GOP is openly racist and serves the dictates of the most conservative elements of the ruling class. But now that the Democratic Party has gone in complete competition with this, with the GOP for who can serve the interests of the rich more effectively, what we've seen is that the entire system has entered this stage of crisis. And that is not a coincidence. They both align with this consolidation politically of the ruling class aligns with this crisis, because this system really can't go forward as it did in prior periods when there was capital, let's say, abroad that could be plundered and looted through wars, when there was an opportunity to develop and advance technologically and meet some of the concessions that poor people and working people demanded. That's no longer possible in the calculations, despite the enormous profits that these corporate fat cats and capitalists are making. They're making the calculation that this system will continue to be unstable and will continue to crash because, one, it serves their interests better that way, and two, the alternative is too far politically close to what you said, Ryan, which is a socialist alternative. The idea that the government should provide for the basic needs of working people. The idea that racism is outmoded and needs to be addressed in a systematic way. And the idea that peace really isn't that foreign of a concept anymore. A lot of people do not see endless wars as serving their interests. And that breaks this whole mold of American exceptionalism, where whatever the US government does is seen as in service of democracy and liberty and freedom. Now, with this state of crisis, this economic depression, this pandemic, which has exposed the complete and utter lack of a public health system, and the fact that Wall Street and multinational corporations do not want to allow a real functional government to exist, to just keep people alive. This is really a crisis of legitimacy that we're seeing. And it really does go down to the very heart of the structure of this society and how it has developed over the course of centuries to lead us to this moment. And hopefully that, as you said, will lead more people into a socialist path. But that takes a lot of work, and that takes the real heart and leadership and blood, sweat, and tears of people who are already there to make that happen, because right now the Democratic Party and the ruling class as a whole is much more interested in fomenting what they're already saying, this rise of the far right. It's they who are fomenting it. The far right is the ruling class. And it's very disturbing to see a lot of folks on this so-called populist left, or, you know, the AOC squad left, say otherwise, because really the United States has always been at the roots of a racist society, a society you cannot separate racism from. And unless we make those connections between the predations of capital, the inherently exploitative relationship between capital and the common good and the people, the workers, the poor, and the function of racism to ensure that that is stable, that that relationship cannot be transformed, because there is a scapegoat, there is an enemy, and that there is either an enemy abroad or an enemy within that can be looked towards to blame for certain problems and ultimately to super exploit in order to make even more of a killing in terms of profits. That is the function of racism, and that is what the Democratic Party is cynically using diversity and all of this kind of window dressing, as you put it, to distract from the fact that anyone who sits inside of the Democratic Party is sitting inside of a racist institution, a capitalist institution, an institution that serves the interests of both. And that only strengthens the GOP. It only strengthens the far right. And it will ensure that somebody farther to the right of Donald Trump will run and run more effectively against the Democrats in future political cycles. And if we don't want that kind of future, then yes, we will have to take up a socialist path.
Yeah, well, and one of the things I think the Democrats also do very sinisterly is, yes, we get it. The Republicans are racist. They are very overtly racist. They don't hide their racism. But like you just alluded to, the Democrats are covertly racist. They will pander, you know, right now the black-white wealth gap in America is as high today and wide today as it was back in 1968 during the Civil Rights Movement. Now, do you see the Democratic Party actually, you know, fighting to defund the police and shift resources into black and brown communities? No. Do you see them fighting for reparations? No. You know, do you see them fighting for any kind of, you know, fundamental socialist policies that would improve the lives of black and brown people and working class people? No. What the Democrats do is they sit and basically virtue signal all day and say, look at those neo-fascists. They're so bad. Ha ha ha. Look at them. They're so awful. And yeah, hello. Yes, they are bad. Now, what are you going to do about it? You know what I mean? But like, that's the thing, is they don't actually want to do anything about the neo-fascism, because they're actually collaborating with the neo-fascists. They're working with the Republicans in Congress to funnel more money to their corporate donors. So their whole kind of strategy is just to sit back, point out the racist, while they're actually passing racist policies. And you have someone like Joe Biden, who is the, you know, the architect of mass incarceration, and, you know, one of the architects of the Iraq war as well, and getting us into that whole mess. And so I just find it so hypocritical that, like, if look, yes, is there racism in this country? Yes. Is there a rise of neo-fascism in this country? Absolutely. Are you going to sit and virtue signal about it? Or are you actually going to take bold action to do something about it? And the Democrats don't want to take any of the necessary actions to do anything about this rise. And like you said, what that just ends up doing is it just emboldens and enables and is going to pave the way for another more dangerous neo-fascist to rise in the Republican Party in 2024 or in 2028. And you actually wrote a very good article about this. It's your new article is out in the Black Agenda Report. It's titled, Joe Biden is a White Supremacist War Hawk Too. And in it you write, and I quote, Joe Biden is a white supremacist and a war hawk, but one would never know just by listening to the corporate media. The ruling class understands that Joe Biden is less popular than Bernie Sanders mittens and has thus focused all of its energy on the optics of his administration. However, endless celebrations of the quote-unquote diversity embodied in Joe Biden's cabinet are nothing but hollow gestures for people under the crossfire of U.S. empire. You go on to say, the politics of representation in the area of U.S. empire amount to a narrow nationalism that places the superiority and exceptionalism of the United States above the lives of colonized people and oppressed people around the world. This is why it is so important for organizations, such as Black Alliance for Peace to develop and strengthen in the coming period. The Trump era left the struggle against empire defenseless from the popularization of white nationalist politics on the one hand, and the Democratic Party's con of diversity on the other. Only an organized left movement can reconcile the contradictions presented by these two ideological wings of a dying imperialist bird of prey. Can you expand on how the Democratic Party and the neoliberal establishment weaponizes identity politics to both protect their corporate power and expand the endless wars and military state, and how the left should respond?
Sure. Well, this has been going on for a while. Consultant-driven neoliberalization of the politics of race is not something new. In fact, it came as a response to this real fear that the Black Liberation Movement and the American Indian Movement, the Indigenous Liberation Movement, the Chicano Movement, all of those movements would end up serving as a potential vanguard for a real class struggle in the United States, not more than 50 years ago. And once that occurred, there was this slight opening up of positions of power, modest at best, to the halls of, let's say, Congress, city council, corporate boardrooms, etc. But it was very modest. But the point was always to ensure that there would be a conservative strain politically within these movements that would shift priorities to establishment politics and the Democratic Party. We can just look at how the Congressional Black Caucus, which we talk about a lot at Black Agenda Report, has behaved in the last several decades, especially during the Obama period. We saw the Congressional Black Caucus vote in vast majorities for the militarization of the police through the 1033 program, and people who are interested in fighting the militarization of the police should sign Black Alliance for Peace's petition on this, which was just released, and you can go to their website for that. But the Congressional Black Caucus, which Kamala Harris was a member of and still is a member of prior to her vice presidency, they voted for the remilitarization of the police over and over again by the Pentagon. And in 2014, when Black Lives Matter was rising up and fighting against this phenomenon, the Congressional Black Caucus was voting for it. The Blue Lives Matter Act of 2018, which made it a federal hate crime to enact any kind of quote-unquote violence against the police, was also passed in wide majorities by the Congressional Black Caucus. So that example alone is indicative of what we talk about when we say that the Democratic Party is really playing politically this game of the con of diversity, using diversity as a weapon to forward the interests of the ruling elite. And it's very evident policy-wise. Now the Biden administration has Lloyd Austin, who was literally a board member of Raytheon, mass weapons manufacturer, one of the biggest military contractors on the planet, and is responsible for the destruction in part of Black and brown nations all over the world. But Lloyd Austin, because he is a Black man, is considered to be a visionary and someone who represents this straight line between the so-called civil rights movement and the ascendancy of folks like Barack Obama and Lloyd Austin. So we now see that when we have Black faces in high places or diverse faces in high faces of any kind, in high places of any kind, there isn't much of a policy difference that occurs. Just look at how the Biden administration already has gone back on some of the few good things that the Trump administration was trying to put into place in terms of foreign policy. The peace negotiations with the Taliban in Afghanistan to potentially withdraw U.S. troops there. Joe Biden has already said that he is going back on that. And you can also look at the petition that Black Alliance for Peace has on that as well. We've also seen people like Kamala Harris, his vice president, over the course of the Trump administration's negotiations with the DPRK's Kim Jong-un, saying how this was an awful moment for the United States and shows that Trump had no respect for the United States' position in the world by simply negotiating with a country that the United States is still technically at war with, and basically saying that peace is not preferable to the United States' superiority as a military power in the Korean Peninsula. These examples alone show that the Democratic Party, when it comes to issues of war and peace, is willing to go to the right of someone like Donald Trump in order to preserve the hegemony of the U.S. empire, in order to preserve the hegemony of the corporate interests that American empire has always been about at the root.
Well, and I always just say very simplistically, a diverse cabinet of corporatists is still a cabinet of corporatists, right? And so just see the black and brown politicians that make it to the upper echelons of the establishment. It's never black and brown politicians who actually support bold progressive policies, or God forbid, a socialist agenda that would actually lift up millions of black and brown people in this country and working class people in this country. You know, it's never the Nina Turners that are, you know, vaulted up there, or, you know, people like Angela Walker who ran for the Green Party. It's always, you know, black and brown politicians like Barack Obama, who is, you know, a corporatist and a war hawk himself, you know. And so when you realize the problem is our system. So if you're just going to put someone, you know, sure, representation is great, but we also need representation of political ideology. We need representation of progressive politics, of socialist politics, of communist politics, of any kind of politics that will break up the status quo, because the status quo is failing us. The systems we have now are failing us. Capitalism is failing us. Imperialism is failing us. These racist institutions are failing us. So just putting a black and brown person in charge of these corrupt systems isn't going to do anything if the black and brown person is just going to continue the corrupt system. And so I think you're absolutely right in the way they've been able to weaponize it and use identity politics to cover up the deeper systemic rot in our country. And I think what's most egregious about it is capitalism is hurting disproportionately, and imperialism, when you look worldwide, it disproportionately impacts black and brown people. Our corrupt system is hurting them at higher rates. Again, like I said, the black and white wealth gap is as wide today as it's been since 1968. And so, you know, that to me, you know, if you're going to, you know, cynically promote black corporatist politicians to continue these systems that are hurting black people, you're giving black people a false sense of hope. You know, you're caring more about black votes than actually about black lives and actually doing something to lift them up. And so it just is as someone who was a lifelong Democrat, you know, up until a year ago, I fell for it. And as an LGBTQ person, the Democratic Party, they pander so hard to my community, but they do it with a flag. You know, now I call it rainbow capitalism, where they say they care about our community, but do you care about our community when you're not fighting for everyone in the LGBTQ community to have healthcare, right? Do you care about our community when you're not fighting for everyone in the community to be paid a living wage and to have, you know, real opportunity in this country? No, you're just pandering with platitudes so you can get our votes. And then we give them our votes and they get power and they turn around and continue the very system that's repressing us. And so, you know, it's been amazing to me in my kind of political awakening just to see how the Democratic Party does weaponize identity politics instead of actually doing things to help the marginalized communities that they say they care about.
Yes, and what the politics of representation, of inclusion, of diversity accomplish in a lot of ways is making the conversation on the left extremely difficult, because what we have is a lot of arguments and debates about whether diversity in and of itself is a good thing or a progressive thing. And those forces who end up occupying seats of real political power, of real positions of status within the imperialist and capitalist albatross within the state, they end up becoming untouchable politically, right? We're seeing this a lot now with the Squad, because now there is pushback on, well, it's been 2-3 years now And there really hasn't been much of a demand. You'll see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, send out an email saying my supporters need to go and report everyone who hashtags Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez Smollett or something like that, some hashtag comparing her to Jussie Smollett. But she won't send out campaign emails to her supporters saying we need to protest at the Capitol for Medicare for All, for example. So now that there is this pushback, the very idea of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez occupying a congressional seat as a Latina woman who says she was working class in her background is seen as in and of itself what we need to protect. We shouldn't be debating whether the politics of representation is a good thing or a bad thing. A great scholar, friend, I consider a friend, Dean Spade, trans scholar, talks a lot about how the whole debate about trans people in the military, for example, has been corporatized, has been turned into a neoliberal talking point to excuse for the fact that the entire political establishment is doing nothing about the disproportionate homelessness that the trans community faces, the disproportionate police brutality, the fact that trans people are discriminated every single day when it comes to healthcare. Those aren't made mass issues within the political apparatus here in the United States, and that's because they really do go at the heart of what this system is all about. And we can look at any issue in regards to any oppressed section of the United States and get to the same place in saying it is the system that's the problem. It's the system of capitalism, it's a system of imperialism, it's a system that breeds hatred, requires a bigotry, requires this kind of division in society, which then allows the real powers that be to maintain their political and economic control. That is always at the heart of every single issue. But when the very existence of a Barack Obama or an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the debate that we are having, then anything the ruling class does is excusable, right? Because now you have a particular kind of politician, a particular person who is allowed to commit war crimes, is allowed to commit this assault against working class people and poor people. And it's okay because they, in fact, look like us, they talk like us, they experienced what we experienced, right? And that cannot be where we go because that legitimizes the entire political structure and is really all about, as we said in our chapters in the book on inclusion and on diversity, our two chapters, that it's really all about preserving American exceptionalism, rendering the United States exceptional when in fact it can't offer anything material to oppress people anymore. Whether it's around the world, waging wars of destruction, saber rattling with China, saber rattling with Russia, sanctioning Syria and starving the people, creating that huge refugee crisis from the US war in Syria. All of this is excusable. And then here in the United States, the massive poverty that black people and poor people experience here. The fact that unemployment is double for black people than it is for white Americans. All of this is excusable as long as there is someone who looks like us, who talks like us. And that is the key part of this whole diversity and politics of inclusion and of identity. That is the whole part that we take issue with at Black Agenda Report because politics really is extracted from the entire conversation and it becomes all about how does this US system of imperialism and capitalism look better, work better, and operate better to the benefit of who, right? And it's not the majority of people, it's not humanity. It's the tiny few who own the means of production and who use them and wield them for their own private profits.
Well, yeah, and also one of the things I think it's we don't have to choose between a class-based analysis or a race-based analysis. We don't have to choose between economic justice and racial justice. We can have both, and we need both. It has to be both. You know, the analysis and it has to be class-based and it has to be race-based. The problem is the neoliberal establishment has no class-based analysis. They have no class-based politics because they are literally stepping on the working class. That is the entire model of the establishment, is to funnel more money to the ruling class and put the endless greed of the ruling class over the basic needs of the poor and the working class. So one of the ways they sinisterly weaponize it is say, well, is use identity politics to say, well, no, look, we care about black and brown people because, you know, we have a few in our party, or look, you know, we just appointed a black man to be the new DNC, the new head of the DNC is a black man. Well, do a little research. He's also a former corporate lobbyist. So again, they weaponize it to kind of distract from the bigger problems and distract from the kind of from the kind of policies that we actually need to help the poor, the working class, and predominantly black and brown people. And so I just, you know, this whole idea that we should choose between race and class is a lie. It's both. We need class-based analysis and we need race-based analysis. We need economic justice and racial justice. We should never be in a position where we have to choose either or. In your book that you've mentioned and that I mentioned at the start, American Exceptionalism and American Innocence, A People's History of Fake News from the Revolutionary War to the War on Terror, that came out, I think, a year ago. I just started reading it, by the way, and I recommend everyone who's listening to pick it up, especially if you want to gain a deeper understanding of the consequences of U.S. imperialism and capitalism. But in your book, you write, and I quote, "American exceptionalism has always presumed national innocence despite imposing centuries of war and plunder. The American nation-state has been at war for over 90% of its existence. These wars have all been justified as necessary ventures meant to defend or expand America's so-called founding values and beliefs. A consequence of centuries of endless war has been the historical tendency of the U.S. to erase from consciousness the realities that surround American domestic and international policy, not to mention the system of imperialism that governs both." You know, growing up in this country, they teach us that we live in the greatest nation on earth. But when I finally took off my blindfold, the only thing that I could see is an evil empire. America is not some shiny beacon on the hill or bastion of freedom or democracy. America is a corrupt, warmongering oligarchy that exports death and destruction, not freedom. There was a report recently that the United States regime has killed 20 to 30 million people since World War II through these endless wars that you talk about in your book, and crippling economic sanctions that leave people in underdeveloped countries to starve. Yet despite all of this death and destruction inflicted on the world by U.S. imperialism, at a Senate confirmation hearing recently, Joe Biden's Deputy Secretary of Defense nominee, Kathleen Hicks, said that she thinks the Pentagon has provided good value to the taxpayer. Danny, do you think the American people paying over $740 billion a year for mayhem, death, and failed wars is a good value to the American taxpayer? And what is keeping so many Americans from having that ultimate realization about the horrors and atrocities that the U.S. empire flicts upon the world?
Very good question. First, shameless plug for the book. The best way you can support it, given the world of publishing, is sign up for my Patreon, patreon.com/Danny Haifong, and I'm giving away copies, free PDF there and everything.
Awesome.
But to continue.
And we'll share that link at the end of the show.
For sure. Thank you. So your question is very good, and it really strikes the heart of what the problem is. American exceptionalism, in the eyes of people like Kathleen Hicks, it really is all about militarism and empire. And in our book, we try to make clear that there really is no freedom here in the United States, no liberation, no socialism, no anything, no progress for humanity or for workers or for anyone oppressed here in the United States, unless we consider just the international ramifications of empire and how American exceptionalism projects the interests of empire around the world and really does convince us, and this is the problem, convinces us that the interests of the empire are in fact aligned with those of us here who are trying to make ends meet and who are trying to survive amid this capitalist and imperialist nightmare here. So this is historical in nature and in character. We really focus on in the book on this ideology, because what Kathleen Hicks is saying is not without premise, because during World War II, as you said through that study, the United States became the imperialist superpower around the world. With that, it became the largest economy in the world and actually had nearly 50% of all global GDP being consumed inside of the United States. That is how powerful an empire the United States once was. That has been declining ever since, of course, for many different reasons. But what that status allowed the United States to do was to placate certain sections of the working class, especially in our labor movement, to kind of condition them into this so-called middle class ideology, this American dream ideology, that in fact the United States was a place where you could pull yourself up by your bootstraps and actually meet your needs, right? And this was never true, because this was all happening during the Jim Crow era, for example. So Black people were still living through the terrorism of Jim Crow, which was economic terrorism in many ways, disallowing Black people from any share of the spoils of empire. But with that meant that there was a section of the United States, a large section of which, not just the elite, which believed that the United States projecting its so-called democratic values abroad brought economic dividends at home. And that has been a huge problem that has continued to influence the class struggle in the United States. And that is why we see the AFL-CIO, for example, be very close and friendly to certain politicians, especially in the Democratic Party, and literally support, sometimes overtly, support U.S. wars, like the AFL-CIO having a relationship with the National Endowment for Democracy in Venezuela, for example, opposing Venezuela's Bolivarian movement in attempt to wrestle control of its resources back to redistribute it to people. That this is historical in character and must be looked at. Her comments must be looked at with that in mind. The reality now, though, is that empire has become a drag on capitalist development itself. And we see that with the fact that the United States spends 60% of its discretionary budget on endless wars, but right now is in an economic depression, negative growth. But even before this economic depression was barely growing, it was at a stagnant rate of growth. So capitalist development itself has been stagnating, largely in part because of the vast investment in military resources. But this investment in military resources is not only crippling the economy, ensuring that investment itself is difficult to accomplish, but it's also not bringing any dividends back to workers in the United States anymore, right? There is this complete waste on the military, which only serves now the military contractors, the politicians who receive large donations from them, and the bloated budget of the Pentagon and its various agencies. That is now a huge dividing point, which it has been more recognized since the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. But still, we have a very little conversation about the consequences of the U.S. empire's huge military albatross abroad. And a lot of that is because people like Kathleen Hicks really promote what is, to me, a racist statement, saying that it serves the American taxpayer. Well, who isn't being served by the U.S.'s imperialist aggression abroad and its military endeavors abroad? Well, it's the millions of people. You cited 20 to 30 million since the end of World War II, and that stopped in 2011. We've had the invasion of Libya. We've had the invasion of Syria. We've had the overthrow of Ukraine. We've had the massive instability from the militarization of Africa engineered by the U.S. African Command. We've had the sanctions imposed on Venezuela, on Syria, on Iran, over and over again. How many more millions have died because of these interventions, largely led by Democrats and largely championed by Democrats? That number would increase by a lot if they were included. But the U.S. doesn't even count the casualties of its wars unless it is U.S. soldiers. And that in and of itself is an example of American exceptionalism and racism, white supremacy, because it's this idea that the United States, being this benevolent, white-ruled, imperialist nation, that its prerogatives matter, regardless of the costs, over everything else, including the lives and the very existence of people around the world. And so Kathleen Hicks, I don't see what she said as being any better than Donald Trump saying S-hole countries in relation to Haiti and African countries around the world. They're very related. It's just that one speaks in code and the other doesn't.
Hmm. Yeah, and that gets back to the, you know, Republicans are overtly racist and Democrats are covertly racist. And one of the other things when I heard that statement, I mean, it's so ridiculous that, like, you know, it's like she's literally brainwashing people right there. Well, no, like investing in the Pentagon has been great for taxpayer money. It's like, no, because when you're spending 60% of the entire budget of our entire government's budget on endless wars, what you're not doing is investing in the people. You're not investing in healthcare. You're not investing in education. You're not investing in infrastructure and investing in opportunity for the American people. And I think that there's such a disconnect between, you know, that's the one area that I feel like nobody really understands how corrupt America's foreign policy is. The taxpayers just go along with it without giving much pushback. And I think one of the ways that, you know, these American capitalists and the American empire has been able to keep its power, even now, like you say, even though the empire is declining and capitalism is declining and is in decay, one of the ways they've been able to stay in power is they've indoctrinated the U.S. masses for almost a century now that, you know, there would be breadlines and poverty under socialism. Yet under capitalism, we have breadlines, we have poverty, we have endless war, we have inequality, we have injustice. And now we have 3 billionaires who hoard more wealth than half of our entire nation. This level of inequality is unsustainable. And it feels like we're at the breaking point now. Humankind has to find a better way than capitalism, imperialism, and racism. It cannot continue exploiting the working class to enrich the ruling class, because a world that's built on greed and war and exploitation will eventually consume itself. I've been reading a lot of Michael Parenti recently, and in his book, Against Empire, he says, and I quote, "The essence of capitalism is to turn nature into commodities and commodities into capital. The live green earth is transformed into dead gold bricks, with luxury items for the few and toxic slag heaps for the many. The glittering mansion overlooks a vast sprawl of shanty towns wherein a desperate, demoralized humanity is kept in line with drugs, television, and armed force." I mean, that sums it all up right there. And you know, Danny, as both capitalist parties in Washington continue to put the endless greed of the ruling class over the basic needs of the people, despite these historic levels of wealth inequality, it's opening up a space once again in America for revolutionary politics. What do you see as the best vehicle to channel all of this revolutionary energy? And what do you see as the best economic and political system to replace our capitalist imperialist oligarchy?
The key question, the one that I enjoy the most. So, yes, first of all, great Michael Parenti quote, amazing scholar. And I just want to first say that you know, you will hear this now that you've had me on the show. Everyone connects me to China because I've done a lot of work with No Cold War around U.S. aggression around China. But I've been to a few socialist countries. And while I don't find it to be unhelpful that a lot of the left movement right now in the United States is looking at Europe and the social welfare systems there, it's also a key to understand that those European countries, whether it's the UK or any one of them, have also been engaging in their own kinds of austerity, maybe not to the degree of the United States, but they are. The national health system in the UK is under constant attack, and it doesn't matter which Nordic country you go to, there are instances of this. And so we need to see capitalism as more of a unified whole rather than a system where there's some sort of more benevolent capitalism out there. Because when the United States and its model of capitalism is in the lead, you can bet that countries all around the world are following, in some degree, to the degree that they can, a similar path. So for me, the real key issue here is power. And if we're talking about socialism, we need to talk about power. Who has power and who doesn't? Because it cannot be that we just settle for pressuring politicians to do what we want them to do. That's only step one. The next step is that possible? Now, those are the questions that happen. Is it possible? Will they negotiate? Will they comply once they negotiate? All of those things. Or will we experience violence, right? State violence or political violence in the form of soft power, for example, which we see all over the movement in the nonprofit industrial complex, NGOs, etc. Is that what we're going to get? Just a different kind of capitalism, which is more friendly? Is that even possible right now? So those are the questions that occur when we start asking questions about power and start organizing in kind based on that question.
And is
But
there
for me,
even, and we're just real quick, is, you know, because there's people like Andrew Yang who, you know, he wants to focus on human-centered capitalism or this kind of benevolent capitalism. And from the work I've done and the reading I've done is, you know, is benevolent capitalism even possible, right? Because at its core, capitalism is a system of exploitation. Capitalism, you know, people say, try to equate it to free markets. And I always find that laughable because how can a market be free if the market is contingent upon exploiting the working class to enrich the ruling class? There's no freedom in that. There's no freedom in exploitation. There's no freedom in exploiting the poor and the working class. So, you know, Jeff Bezos can have $200 billion while, you know, the poor can barely keep their heads above water. And so, you know, this whole idea of kind of benevolent capitalism, I don't even think that's possible. You know, and I think that's part of the debate because the longer you know you try to save capitalism, the more suffering that's going to continue for the poor and the working class. And then you know you add in the climate crisis, and capitalism is like gasoline on the climate crisis. And these big oil companies that both corporate parties in Washington provide subsidies to. And so when you look at just the massive crises we face from capitalism to the climate crisis to imperialism. I don't believe saving capitalism or this kind of benevolent capitalism is what's best. I believe what's best is to transition to an eco-socialist and some type of economy where the working class holds the means of production, where you have equal, you know, wealth distribution, and you don't have, you know, everyone has a home and healthcare and food, and you don't have three people who own more wealth than half of our entire nation.
Yes, and that gets me into the second part of what I was about to go into, which is that when we finally go through this struggle, and what has happened worldwide historically is that much poorer nations that have long histories of the most violent and oppressive experiences with imperialism and colonialism, have actually been in the lead in charting the course of what it looks like to implement socialism with actual political power for masses of people. So rather than saying, okay, are we fighting for a more benevolent kind of capitalism or social welfare kind of socialism, where yes, there's capitalists in control of the government, but we have more benefits at least? It's really been the poorest of those around the world, those who have experienced the most intense suffering from imperialism, which have had to chart a course of socialism out of devastating and really just completely enormous odds around their own survival, whether this system can even be upheld under such dire, impoverished conditions. I've been to two such countries that have experienced this. I've been to Cuba and I've been to China. And both countries have long histories, centuries long, colonialism, imperialism, devastating, dividing up their countries, instituting vile forms of racism, all for British colonial powers, the United States, Spain, etc. But to now, these countries have decided that no, a socialist path is actually preferable. And while everyone wants to have a debate whether China is socialist or not, the point of the matter is that China spends more on poverty alleviation than the United States spends on education in the United States. And China is one-fifth of the per capita GDP of the United States. So the fact that China is putting more resources into the livelihoods and progress of the poor than the United States says something about its economic system that is profoundly different than the United States. In Cuba, nearly 100% of people own their own homes, not just have a home, which 100% of people do, but own their own home, which means it's theirs. And despite the fact that the United States, since 1960, has leveled starvation sanctions on the country to the point where it is difficult. If you go, you will see it. China doesn't have this problem because it made the calculated decision that it needs to have relationships around the world and make certain concessions. But Cuba has never had that luxury 90 miles away from the United States. And you can see the effect of sanctions, the fact that people have a hard time fixing their homes because they can't import certain products in order to make certain repairs. Concrete, for example, is extremely expensive for Cuba because they can't port ships. And so they have to find other ways to trade with countries around the world at times without being able to get certain resources. But even still, life expectancy has risen in Cuba by more than 40 years since 1959 alone, making it a beacon of hope for poor people in Latin America and in countries in Latin America, which have a united experience with Spanish colonialism and then the United States' imperialist form of exploitation. And that, I think, says something about power, right? When people do have the power to determine their destiny, when they really do have a government that represents their interests, not just, oh, I can elect that person. It's that government is me. That government reflects my national interests. It reflects my economic interests. And if it doesn't do what I want, then it will change. That is, to me, the definition of what socialism needs to look like in the United States. It cannot just be, okay, we are fighting for these welfare reforms, universal policies, which we need and we should continue to make demands for. But if we're only focusing on, will AOC and Ilhan Omar and will we be able to convince Nancy Pelosi, especially, to give us Medicare for All, then we will continuously find ourselves in this battle. And so for me, the political vehicle we need to build is an independent political party that represents the interests of working class people and operates not just electorally, but operates as a full expression of what workers need, operates as an organization that doesn't just focus all of its energy to organize elections, but also focuses energy on how to organize people, how to build a real labor movement, how to build a real peace movement, and to pour resources that work, the few resources that workers have, into doing that. And that is how you build trust with working people. That's how you build trust with oppressed people, is by building a vehicle that does that. And that's a very big challenge, and we haven't been able to figure that out just yet.
Well, and there's a lot of different parties that are kind of trying to figure out. And I think one of the obstacles the left, I've noticed, has as I'm kind of figuring out where to put my energy and figure out what is next, is that there are so many different smaller parties on the left. You know, even for instance, under socialism, I mean, there's three or four different parties, right? And so you end up getting a lot of fractured interest because, you know, so many people who, you know, have the compassion and the empathy to build something that helps the poor and the working class and to truly organize, it's like our energies are put in so many different vehicles. And so we don't have one united, you know, we don't have one united effort against the duopoly and against capitalism. What do you think are some ways that we can kind of build more solidarity across the left? So we can start to kind of all be moving in that one direction. You know, I think for me, I mean, I'm an anti-capitalist. I believe we need to move to an economic system beyond capitalism that is rooted in socialism. But even then, there are like four different parties that are rooted in socialism on the left. And again, I think that makes it challenging as I'm kind of reading and learning about every different thing. I've also been helping MPP, which isn't necessarily rooted in socialism. And so I'm kind of, You know, I'm in a space where I'm just kind of exploring and seeing what is the right path. I think also one of the things that prevents us from changing is each person maybe in those smaller groups thinks that like, this is the way, or no, this is the way. And everyone is so dead set that they have the way and think that they have the answers. And I'm starting to kind of come to a conclusion of like, I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the exact path is. I just know we need to move beyond capitalism and move to a more sustainable and equitable economy, a system, again, that's rooted in more socialism. And rooted in socialism, but how do we prevent like the, you know, you got some people in DSA who think the Democratic Party can be reformed, which I don't. And then you have people in the Party of Socialism and Liberation. You have the Green Party. Yeah, you have the Socialist Party, the Socialist Alternative Party, the Communist Party, the Socialist Equality Party, who I had on last week. So there's like five different efforts. Right. Do you see where I'm going with this? It's like, how do we get one united effort, or how do we build solidarity amongst everyone who wants to live in a post-capitalist nation?
Very, very good question. And I think there is real no crystal ball on how to do that. I think part of it has to be, there needs to be more political education and more public debate that these organizations need to move beyond whatever they're doing individually and begin to look towards reaching out and uniting across certain issues in order to have these kind of debates and in order to ultimately reach the masses of people. Because what ends up happening in these organizations is that they can become detached from masses of people when they aren't able, and no one's saying, you know, any of these organizations or individuals even has the capacity alone, but the only way to engage with the masses is to engage in mass struggle, to engage in the issues that people care most about. And there are many different issues right now that I think are very pertinent. It's not just the climate crisis, which we talked about. It's not just Medicare for all. And it's not just, let's say, the Black Lives Matter movement and this idea of racist policing. There are so many issues day to day that people are going through. Finding ways to build movements, to build certain kinds of efforts and campaigns that really do strike at the heart of what masses of people need and want right now, I think is the first step. And that's difficult because there's so many things to get into. I mean, look at the ills that the capitalist and imperialist system produces. It's not an easy thing, but I think that's the first step, is finding which, and not everyone is going to be able to do everything. So we all have to then organize based on what we can do and unite on what ultimately makes us come together on certain things. So there's lots of components, but the socialist movement, the communist movement, especially in the United States, has struggled a long time with sectarianism, with a lot of which was a product of state infiltration and all sorts of things dating back to the McCarthy period of the 50s into the Cuento Pro period of the 60s and 70s. There is a lot of bad blood, divisions, things that still happen to this day that I won't say publicly, but I know about it because I've been involved in some of these organizations and see how this can operate personally. But right now, this is a moment of crisis, and we all have to figure out where is our role in this. And it is going to be exploratory, because part of being a socialist, in my opinion, is being a dialectical materialist, meaning you understand that there are two sides, that there are many sides to everything. And one side is that we are subjectively trying to figure out, us as people experiencing this oppression, this exploitation, this world of imperialism, that we are responding to it. But a lot of developments happen also by how the system responds, how the system operates. Objectively, the reality that we face will inevitably shape which direction we go in. So we're always dealing with that struggle between what we want to do and what is possible. And right now, we have to debate about both of those things. What is possible right now? What are the actions people are willing to take? Are they willing, like people have thrown out general strike, are people willing to do that right now? Maybe. Do people have the institutions they need to do that? Definitely not. So we have these kind of questions we need to ask and be in debate and discussion with all forces who are willing to be involved in this and ultimately decide. And I think joining an organization is the first step. You know, I do the No Cold War campaign, support Black Alliance for Peace. That's the first step. The next step is, what is our activity achieving? Some of us will be journalists, writers. Some of us will be those who are organizing political education. And some of us will be on the front lines organizing workers, right, into unions. Some of us will be building campaigns for Medicare for All. And in all of those efforts, there will be debates. And I think one of the things we struggle with the most is having political discussion, actually conducting it, actually making it happen in these struggles, right? It's one thing to have a demonstration. It's another thing, are you doing the organizing tasks needed to make sure that those folks who come now have somewhere to go? And now you can discuss what's happening, right, in the world, in the United States. And now you can start to move more people in an organized direction. And we struggle a lot with that right now. And part of that is, we're living through an unprecedented moment of economic and political crisis. And that's where that struggle of objective and subjective conditions ultimately leads us. So it's not an easy path, but I think anyone who is engaging with organizations, who's trying to join them, is on the right one. And then the next step is, how do we then build the vision for socialism, build the struggle for socialism on the ground? There are no easy answers, but we have history as a guide and we have theory as a guide. So we also need to take those things into account. And it's lifelong, and we never know, right? A lot of people see pessimism right now. It's a dark moment, pandemic, yeah. Economic crisis, endless wars, life expectancy is dropping in the United States. It seems like nothing is going right for the majority of people, but you never know. What moment? We didn't think that the Black Lives Matter uprising would happen in 2014 or 2020. We didn't know that was, no one could predict. Occupy Wall Street of 2011, right? No one could predict that that would happen. So we never know when there will be mass uprisings against the predations and the exploitation of capital, but we do know it's going to happen. And that means we have to be prepared once it does happen, to organize and direct it into channels that are not necessarily acceptable to the ruling class. That's another thing we struggle with, is when it does happen, we end up unfortunately getting invested into channels that are more acceptable to the ruling class, like the Democratic Party.
Well, that's what I was going to say, actually, is I think actually that has been the biggest thing for me holding back the socialist movement in this country that's so needed right now, and even the progressive movement to a lesser degree, is that so much energy, progressive energy and even socialist energy, is being directed into a capitalist party that wants nothing to do with progressivism or socialism. That to me is kind of the big insanity of it, that we're putting so much energy into funneling power for the people into a party in the Democratic Party that's then just crushing that power for the people. And I think until we get clear about that, and I didn't get clear about that until about 6 months ago when I started getting involved with MPP, because it became real clear to me after what they did to Bernie again that the Democratic Party is always going to rig the primary against the most progressive candidate. The Democratic Party is always going to protect their corporate donors. The DNC is a private organization. They care about maintaining the status quo and continuing to get their corporate donors in. They don't care about the working class and the poor. And so as long as there's people who don't understand that or think that we should put our time and energy into building up a party that a capitalist party and thinking you can make a capitalist party become a socialist party or even a progressive party, I think that's pretty delusional. And I think just look and see now, there's a new report out. House Democrats have unveiled the message they plan to hammer throughout the 2020 cycle. And here's what their message is, Danny. Amidst all this struggle, amidst all this inequality and all this injustice, their message is that the Republican Party is the party of QAnon. And I quote, the Republicans can do QAnon or they can do college-educated voters. They cannot do both. That is a direct quote from the DCCC chair, Sean Patrick Maloney. So the Democrats' messaging has now gone from Trump is bad to GOP is QAnon. Forget about fighting for actual policies that help the poor and the working class. They're just going to keep taking that corporate money, demonizing their opponent, and scream at anyone like us who dares to demand better. This is why it is absolutely outrageous to me that most people still cannot see how complicit these neoliberal corporate Democrats are in paving the way for GOP fascism, as we kind of alluded to earlier. Instead of actually doing something about the fact that capitalism is in decay and failing the poor and the working class, Democrats just want to maintain the failed status quo and virtue signal about how bad Republicans are while they're literally collaborating with them in Congress to funnel more money to Wall Street, giant corporations, and the ruling class. Danny, what is your reaction to Democrats' messaging for the 2022 midterms? And does the fact that they are doubling down on their failed neoliberal politics make it even more urgent for the left to finally break away from the Democratic Party and build power for the people in a party outside of the duopoly?
Yes, that's the key here. I mean, if there is any struggle that, especially for those folks who are already electorally inclined, if there isn't, and paying attention more to that, because to be honest, U.S. electoral politics does dominate the political sphere here in the United States. The atmosphere, everything is dominated by it. And while I think that's a mistake, the first thing that we need to figure out, the very first task we have in front of us, is how do we break the captivity of really the most revolutionary forces in the United States? We have working class people as a whole, mainly in the Democratic Party. And I totally disagree with folks who have said that the GOP has somehow realigned with the working class. I don't believe that one bit. And it definitely doesn't show up demographically. And when it comes to the number of black voters, especially, that every cycle end up saving the Democrats whenever there is a close election and it goes in their favor, I think we see a different picture, that actually working class people and black people, especially in the Democrat, are mainly in the Democratic Party. That means that our most revolutionary forces in this nation's history, right? Whenever there's been a progressive or left movement in the United States, it's included those forces. Those forces are the ones who ultimately make the sacrifices, who do fight, and who do forward what has ever been any kind of conception of socialism in the United States. And you know, we're in Black History Month now, so it's important to remember that part of Black history and not just the part that we get told, which is Martin Luther King said, "I had a dream one day," and completely erases the fact that he was killed because he was standing up against the Vietnam War and organizing with black sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. So the big mission, I think, that all leftists should have, the big vision that they should have, is first, how do we weaken the Democratic Party, which to many people is, especially these neoliberal forces, they see as an existential threat to their future, an existential threat to their domination and hegemony, which means oftentimes just saying that seems counterproductive. And a lot of people on the left, especially those who call themselves democratic socialists, would also find disagreement with the fact that we need to weaken the Democratic Party. But the kind of weakening I'm talking about is weakening its stranglehold over the political direction of the most revolutionary forces here in the United States. That's the only way we are going to be able to talk about the questions in the last segment we just did. The only way we get to those questions is if the force that is directed and organized to send movements, social movements, into political graveyards, the only way we move forward is if that force is the target of our struggle. And that is, I think, inevitably going to need to happen. If we just think about what just happened in the last two election cycles, we had millions of people, millions of young people, young workers here in the United States, and workers of all political and social affiliations supporting the Bernie Sanders campaign and supporting the campaigns of the Squad, for example, and then being completely unorganized afterward, right? Where is the organization of these forces? How come it should be easy to organize these forces, to mobilize, to demand certain kinds of policies, but it's not. And why is that? Because all of the energy was put into a Democratic Party campaign, which inevitably leads to a massive expenditure of monetary and social resources within a political party, which is designed to exclude them, designed to absorb them and then spit them out, chew them up and then spit them out, and leaving a kind of distaste, which is not necessarily easy to organize out of, because contrary to what a lot of people believe, it's not deceleration or accelerationism, right? It's not the worsening of conditions that ultimately leads to an organized movement. It's the idea that there is some kind of possibility for grassroots struggle to achieve, which convinces people to join it. And so if we continue to organize grassroots forces into the Democratic Party, we are going to continue to experience losses, which only means people are going to become more detracted from socialism. They may believe in it, right? And I always say this, 90% of people, 100, 100% of people may want universal healthcare, but if they don't believe it can happen, they're not going to fight for it, right? And that is the, I think, what the difference between electoral politics and actually, you know, I've been a part of unions, I've been a part of some of these organizations, and I've seen that's what happens. If you can't win in your union struggle, if you can't fight for a better contract, if you're not able to mobilize against the boss and you're not able to demand more, a lot of workers are going to say, what's the point?
What's,
you know,
the point?
Of course I want a raise. Of course, right. I want better health care.
And that's what, that's what's happened with most Democratic voters. These ones that you're talking about, predominantly working class and black and brown people, their material conditions haven't gotten better by supporting the Democratic Party. Yet they still keep supporting it and just basically accepting the breadcrumbs that the neoliberal establishment will give them. And you get to this point of like, well, you know, this is as good as we're going to get, so we might as well just, you know, hold our nose again and vote for the Democratic Party one more time. And, you know, just bigger picture, America will never get better if every 4 years our two choices are neoliberalism or neofascism. It will never get better as long as corporations control both parties and corporate greed rules Washington. We have to break free. We have to break the massive stranglehold that corporate money has over both parties and over our entire government in Washington. And I think the only way to do that is to build grassroots movements outside of the Democratic Party or, you know, both of these corporate parties. Because again, to just funnel, it's so amazing to me how the Democratic Party for now 70 plus years, it kind of co-opts the language of the progressive movement without actually supporting the policies that progressives are fighting for. Or it co-opts, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, where you have politicians say, oh, well, you know, Black Lives do matter, but we're not going to defund the police. You know, or they'll say, you know, healthcare is a human right, but we're not going to support Medicare for all. Or, you know, climate change is real, but we're not going to support a Green New Deal. So again, it's like the co-opting and then they basically destroy these movements. Like, look at Bernie's movement. It's all gone into the Democratic Party now, and it's pretty much there. And yeah, there's this kind of new movement to, you know, expand the squad. But I just think we're in a moment like where it's going to take 40 years to get enough squad members to pass Medicare for all. If that's the strategy, it's so passive. And it also, if your whole theory of the case is that you can change the party from within, and I don't believe in that case. I believe that a capitalist party is a capitalist party. You can't move Wall Street left. You can't move the Democratic Party left. You're never going to make the Democratic Party a progressive party, yet alone a socialist party. But even if you did think you could, how are you going to do that if the squad, if AOC, are not going to fight back aggressively against Nancy Pelosi and against Joe Biden? And I think a lot of this division we're seeing now on the left, people think it's like, you know, that it's really just a matter of like the people who fought so hard to elect AOC, and AOC said she was going to support Medicare for all. Now she's not even fighting for Medicare for all. She's not putting pressure on Pelosi. And so it's like, you know, if you're going to try to claim to be a progressive in a neoliberal party, you can't become friends with the neoliberals in the party. You got to fight back against them if you want to see any victories for the working class. And now I feel like that the progressives and the squad have just kind of become swept up into the establishment. And instead of fighting back against the establishment for victories for the working class, they're kind of joining in with them. And I've definitely seen a shift. And so me just calling that out, or any progressive calling that out, we get attacked. And what I find so interesting is they attack me personally Even though I've never once attacked AOC personally. I've never said fraud squad. I don't necessarily believe in fraud squad. But I don't believe that anyone is above reproach. And I don't believe, especially a politician who ran to be progressive and ran to challenge the status quo, you should be able to criticize them based on the fact that A, they're not doing that. And B, you should be able to make policy critiques and say, if you campaigned on Medicare for All, fight for it. Fight for a Medicare for All floor vote. Put some pressure on Pelosi. That's all I've done. And I've never attacked AOC one time personally. I actually extended solidarity to her after she shared about her trauma and after she shared about, you know, her sexual abuse. I extended solidarity. I literally tweeted, I stand in solidarity with AOC. And literally a few hours later, a couple of her big super fans took my I stand in solidarity with AOC and said, you're responsible for this. You have a direct role. I'm not kidding. I quote, you have a direct role in what happened. I mean, that is a level of delusion to think that me demanding AOC or any politician just fight for the policies they campaigned on, that that somehow meant I had a role in the insurrection or a role in her trauma. Like, it's delusional. And, you know, we're kind of getting to the end here, but like, how are we ever going to have change in this country if we're not even allowed to criticize our politicians or demand better from our politicians without being personally attacked for simply just demanding that they do their jobs, right? Like, it's just so crazy to me that now, instead of like in a culture, in a capitalist culture where celebrities get put on pedestals and worshiped, we've now put the few politicians that are supposed to be progressive on these pedestals that we're not even allowed to expect anything out of AOC or demand better from AOC, because I get blamed for causing the insurrection when I was out in LA and I had nothing to do with the insurrection. I mean, sorry to vent here a little bit, but it's just absolutely delusional to me. What's going on here, Danny? Help me. It's like I can't fucking take it.
Well, it's full circle, really, because what you're explaining is kind of what we began with, right? This idea that this politics of adversity or even beyond this, because it's beyond this now, because not the politics of diversity are now mixing and melding with this kind of concession that at least progressives think they have won through the election of the squad, right? A lot of folks think that is a step in the right direction. And hey, I'm not going to argue with the fact that there is something to say about being able to do that. There's obviously a sentiment in the United States and a condition in the United States that we need to study more and see what we can do about it, because obviously they reflect a growing support for certain progressive policies and also a growing decline in support for the exploitation and the oppression of this system, right? And that is obvious, and we should be able to say that, right? This is the fact that Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in the U.S. His mittens, as I said in my article, are more popular than Joe Biden. Yeah, there's a reason for that. Because right. People do look at Bernie Sanders and say, hey, this guy is fighting for ordinary folks.
He fights for me.
Yeah, he fights for me. And that is a mass sentiment among a lot of people. And so the problem is, though, is that what ends up happening, and this is why the Democratic Party is so dangerous, is that this has been used against the very forces who think that they are fighting for massive social change. Now, the Democratic Party has learned, yes, we can co-opt this movement and we can control it because, hey, it's within our structure. It's within our institution, the DNC. I mean, we can manipulate it. And so what ends up happening is the promotion of a failed strategy. It is not a strategy to say, just because we have elected the squad, for example, or just because Bernie Sanders is popular, that this is going to lead to the change that we want to see. No, because as you said, it's going to take how many years for us to elect a party that looks like the squad? And when that happens, look who controls the party. It's Wall Street. It's the military contractors. They're not going to allow it to happen. And we've seen it over and over and over again that they're not even going to allow it to become a trend. They're going to squash it. And that's what this is all about, this equation of the left, the real left, with the right. It's about promoting a failed strategy, and it's about sending the Sandernistas and those who support the squad and the Democratic Socialists and all of them to the graveyard of the Democratic Party. And moreover, you know, we can really look at social change, right? I think In the United States, the ruling class wants us to see social change as a static phenomenon, linear. It goes in one direction or it goes in the other. But that's not how reality works, right? The struggle is all about ebbs and flows. If we look at, for example, the statistic that a lot of folks have shared, that black wealth in the United States is, it would take the average black family, the median black family, 228 years to catch up to the average white family. Ugh. Well, we know in the United States that wealth is not stagnant, right? Capitalism is constantly in motion, constantly looking to accumulate wealth for the few at the expense of the many, especially targeting black people. So we know that the situation is even more dire, or the statistic that by 2053, black wealth will be zero if current trends persist. We know capitalism is always falling into crisis. We're in a depression now. There's no way that that isn't going to happen sooner, because we have an understanding that these forces that we're talking about, the very system that we live in, is constantly in motion around a certain set of prerogatives. And that applies to all politics. So if we can't look at, we need to elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or someone like her in every single seat, and that will get us Medicare for all 40 years later. It won't. Because what will the United States look like in 10 years, in 15 years, right? If you read the National Security Strategy of the United States, you can see that the United States is looking at the fall of its empire way sooner than that. It is targeting the biggest countries around the world for possible nuclear warfare. We see the climate crisis is in motion. We see the economic crisis is in motion. These developments are not static, and they're not going to wait for 40 years. So I think that's the point that we need to really hold on to and let it inform what we do from here. And I think that needs to be figuring out any possible way to break the left from the Democratic Party.
Yeah. And we don't have, you know, the time is right now. We don't have any more time to wait for the fundamental changes that we need to lift up the poor and the working class and communities of color. The moment is now. We are facing so many crises. We are in a pandemic, and the Democratic Party still wants to, you know, peddle business as usual and the same failed politics that created Trump in the first place. That means we have an opportunity to provide real opposition to the Democratic Party and opposition, and provide a new form of politics where you know, the people come before corporations, where peace comes before war, and where justice comes before racism and the corruption that we see from our capitalist system. So we continue the fight. This has been such an, we went over today a little bit. Apologies for that. I could have talked to you for another hour, Danny. You're so insightful. And so I want to thank you for coming on the show today. And how can my listeners get your book? How can they find you to, you know, follow you on Twitter and get your a copy of that book?
Sure. So the best way to support my work right now is patreon.com/Danny Haifong, because I'm doing a whole lot around the book, and you can get a free copy of the book that way. You know, on Twitter, you can follow me at Spirit of Ho, Spirit of H-O. And you can, you know, definitely follow No Cold War, follow Black Alliance for Peace, and definitely subscribe to Black Agenda Report, which has a new issue each week. Those are the primary places you can follow me. But right now, patreon.com/Danny Haifong has all of my work, where you can find, because I'm freelancing sometimes. I'm doing work like this that I want to share with folks, and it's the best place to find me right now.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you so much, Ryan. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight. And before I go, I want to thank our benefactors who donate $20 a month to the podcast. I want to thank Ed Romo, Lloyd Chapman, John Lippman, Sarah Aziz, Tiffany Mahmood, John Paul DeLuca, Susan Sarandon, DJ Comatose, Patty Cleary, and Elizabeth Kim. Thank you so much for your generous donations. And thank you, everyone, for supporting the podcast and supporting my work. I really appreciate it. Again, go to patreon.com/ampedup if you want to support the podcast as well. And for as little as $5 a month, you'll get access to our bonus content. Have a great weekend, everyone, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode of Amped Up with Ryan Knight.